Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. As always, this is your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Well, I think you must have to agree with me that our soapboxes have been extraordinary since we came back from break. We had Tommy Chong on last week talking about sensible marijuana policy. We had Ethan McCord from the WikiLeaks collateral murder tape. That show has gone all over the place, and the transcripts of that show, you can go to CindySheehanSoapbox.blogspot.com to find the transcripts for the Tommy Chong show and the Ethan McCord show. We are starting to put transcripts up after the show every week, so I hope you enjoy that, and I hope you can pass the word around, because Cindy Sheehan Soapbox is one of the boldest, most truth-telling show on the Internet. It should be on the radio. We're working to get it back up on the radio. These days, it's extremely difficult to raise money and to get the truth, really get money for the truth to put it on the air. So today's show, speaking of that, today's show we'll be talking to probably one of the most notable and bravest person who boldly stood up against all odds and against great adversity and threat to tell the truth about what was happening in Vietnam, you know, these 40 or so years ago. And this is really important, what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about how we are being, once again, from this Obama administration, having the wool pulled over our eyes, talking about how the war in Iraq is over now. So stay tuned, and we'll be talking to Daniel Ellsberg.
Since the beginning of time, mankind has waged war. Rarely has there ever been a noble cause for this slaughter. In 1935, between World War I and World War II, Major General Smedley Butler wrote a treatise from the perspective of a U.S. Marine career that spanned decades. This treatise was called War is a Racket. Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox and Piece of the Action have collaborated to publish the 75th anniversary edition. The U.S. military-industrial complex is still profiting while our young people are still killing and dying. The U.S. military-industrial complex commits massive resources to preying on our children, and we in the peace community must be proactive in stopping that. War is a Racket should be in every family home, school library, youth group, and peace group. Please go to www.warisaracket.net for ordering information. And follow us on Facebook at War is a Racket 75th Anniversary Edition.
As I said in my opening, we will be talking to Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel Ellsberg is famous and renowned, and rightfully so, for exposing the Pentagon Papers during the regime of the Nixon administration. So, Daniel, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox again.
Glad to be here, Cindy.
Oh, it's always our honor to have you. And there's just a lot of stuff going on in the news, especially around things that I would consider you the foremost expert, and probably in the United States at least, around these issues. And the first thing I want to talk to you about is the WikiLeaks. You know, we have the WikiLeaks collateral murder tape, and WikiLeaks just released like over 91,000 documents about the war in Afghanistan. What I want to ask you about is, what impact do you think that they've had on, first of all, what impact have they had on the American psyche, and then what impact, if any, have they had on U.S. policy? Because we know that your courageous act, you know, had a huge impact on the war in Vietnam.
Well, I'm no expert on the American psyche, I have to say, but there are polls that have come out just in the week after the WikiLeaks disclosures, which showed a drop in support for the war which was the sharpest, I think they said, in the that they've had in the last year. So they did attribute it to the WikiLeaks. That's good, on the whole good. I am certainly among those who are opposed to the war, as you are. However, one has to say that doesn't immediately translate into any change in government policy. In fact, the Pentagon Papers themselves, when they came out, had a big effect on public opinion, but it was really already against the war by that time.
A majority
were against the war and increased the majority, but that didn't have any effect on Nixon's policy directly. What did affect him eventually was being faced with impeachment and possible prosecution, which led to his resignation, and that in turn was directly based on, not on the Pentagon Papers, but on his fear that I had other more current information about his own administration that I was going to release. And to stop me from doing that, he took a number of steps which were then criminal. I have to put it that way because a number of those are no longer criminal thanks to 9/11 and the Patriot Act and other acts here. For example, he went into my doctor's office to get information to blackmail me with into silence. That's legal now under the Patriot Act, a sneak and peek operation, even into a doctor's office. Or I was heard on warrantless wiretaps, which were then illegal and now legal, although I would still say unconstitutional, but Congress has legitimized them. And an attempt actually to assault me or possibly kill me. That's not legal on the whole here in the U.S., although when the White House spokespeople talk about the president's right to assassinate, to order special forces to assassinate American citizens abroad, they also talk about getting terror suspects wherever they might be, and that would seem to include the United States. So that his saying that doesn't make it legal, but it certainly implies that he regards it, that is the president, regards it as legitimate. So coming back now, those were the acts that then brought Nixon out of office and did help end the war. Now, a number of those acts would be legal and wouldn't result in facing Obama with impeachment. But as far as his willingness to change the policy based on public opinion, I'm not confident that it's any better than Nixon's.
Right. So, but you, if you look at a long view of history, of course, what you did was significant, and you really were facing some significant, punishment or retribution for what you did. What do you think? Do you think even that, this was my question, do you think even that the release of the WikiLeaks material has even changed the rhetoric of the empire? Because I was recently reading that, Stanley McChrystal's program was to, allegedly reduce civilian casualties in Afghanistan, which of course it didn't, but it was allegedly supposed to, and that the new person who's in charge of Afghanistan, what's his name, the new
Atreus.
New general,
Atreus.
Pardon me?
Atreus.
How can I forget that? That he is going to even change that policy that McChrystal had to
back and forth on that. At first, when he first came in, he said he was going to re-examine it. More recently, they're claiming that they haven't changed it very much. But of course, as the even if they did reduce, their willingness to use air attacks or artillery attacks in response to troop requests, the fact is that the number of those requests is almost certain to go up very largely, and even if proportionately they kill fewer civilians per strike, they'll still end up killing more civilians as we have more troops over there and as they take part in more operations. So civilian casualties are a big and probably growing part of our operations over there.
Well, and that's just so tragic and so disgusting. Before we get into the Iraq situation, I do want to ask you one more thing about the WikiLeaks. I am just very impressed with your stamina. You've been doing a lot of interviews around the WikiLeaks situation. How do you think the coverage has been in what we want to call the mainstream or corporate media around this, around the WikiLeaks issue?
There's a growing tendency to follow the Pentagon line and focus on the question of whether WikiLeaks endangered some informants over there and distract, I would say, from the larger issue, which is obviously the purpose of putting these out was to question and lead opposition to our overall operations there, to get us to come home, basically, and save the lives of American troops and, for that matter, their informants by bringing both the troops and the informants back to the United States. That was something, by the way, we could have done a lot better in Vietnam. In leaving Vietnam, it was not really honorable to leave a lot of people who had collaborated with us
there,
thousands of them, including some friends of mine, and put them, subject them to imprisonment in that case. For quite a long period, we should have brought back an enormously greater number. Well, again, I think that to the extent that we have tempted and encouraged and induced Afghans to collaborate with us, a foreign occupier, it's up to us, I think, to safeguard those people as much as possible by bringing them here or somewhere where they, in case they would be endangered by whatever follows us. However, the early media coverage by the New York Times and by then the Guardian and the Der Spiegel, who took part in this, was pretty good. It did bring out a lot of the substance of this, and I think led to this drop in public support that we saw in the following week by making it very plain that, as in Vietnam, we're in a totally stalemated, bloody war there that is escalating and which offers no hope whatever of achieving any kind of success, any kind of benefit for legitimate U.S. interests. And the question that you raised about Iraq, what was the noble purpose or any purpose for which your son sacrificed, is, of course, should be raised with every troop over there. Why are they risking their lives? Why are they doing this? And why are they killing Afghans? To what end? To what purpose? And there is no good answer to that. So I think this enormous release of 90,000 documents and more to come, it seems, really makes that pretty plain, that there really is in any of those documents no indication either of an end in sight under current policies or of any benefit to be served. And that's an important question to be raised, whether the American political system will respond to that question remains to be seen. Not necessarily, but it's up to us.
Well, we, recently heard, I'm sure, that the military and the government have known for a long time that Afghanistan, has billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of precious minerals and oil under its sand. And so it's not a legitimate U.S. interest, but it sure is a legitimate interest for the war profiteers, which seems to be the reason why there's no noble cause, because profiting off of other people's death and the destruction of countries and ways of life is, of course, not noble, but that's what we usually get into these wars for.
We hear of all the different motives for wars on both sides through history. Somebody remarked to me the other day that he questioned whether there had ever been a war, or at least in modern times, any war in modern times in which it was not the case that someone stood to make a lot of money out of it. And that seems like a great simplification. I think it carries you pretty far. That's, by the way, not just that they stood to make money, but that was an absolutely critical aspect to the motives for going to war. It seems, as I say, we go to college, to high school and to college, to learn very elaborate systems for justifying government action is what it comes down to. It's all so complicated and nuanced and ambiguous, and you really have to leave these questions to people who have all the information and all the clearances and so forth. And so there's a great disdain for anything that seems too simple as an explanation, and above all, a great disdain for anything that seems to talk to about profit or income. But actually, when you look at the motives that go into these things, that always figures very critically.
Well, in a capitalist society, it's, you know, not just for profit, it's to exhaust resources and exhaust markets. When resources get exhausted in one place, you have to open up a market in another place. And for capitalism to exist, that's what needs to happen.
Well, it isn't only capitalists who make wars. This goes back a long way. I think we do have, I don't know if I'm disagreeing with you or not, I'm not disagreeing with you about capitalism, but certainly wars precede capitalism, however you define it.
Well, of course.
It seems too easy to get humans mobilized by fear and hatred and take those two, and feelings of patriotism that are said, are invoked in order to get people to kill and to sacrifice their own lives. It's regrettably easy to get humans to do that. I don't know whether we'll survive that tendency as a species.
Well, and you said that we, you know, there's this myth that we just have to listen to the elected officials or the people who are, you know, making enormous profits off of these wars, or the media that is owned mostly by war profiteers. But I want to ask you, because you're one of the smartest people I know, and, you know, you're an analyst and you look at these things. What do you think we should do in Afghanistan? Do you think the president is right in tripling the troop commitment over there, and, you know, billions of more dollars of money that we don't have going towards Afghanistan?
Well, that could be called a leading question. What do you think I think, Cindy, about that?
Well, I know what you think, but...
It's disastrous. It's really not an easy one even to explain how he could be doing this, although I think I do know an explanation, at least... An immediate issue I think he's facing was the fear that his generals, some of them, like Petraeus specifically, and McChrystal before he got fired, would resign and would charge him with weakness, with confirmation that he really was a Muslim at heart and probably wasn't an American, all these things, as proven by the fact that he was not willing to pursue and give them the resources for what they called a winnable war. Now, it's very hard for me to decide whether McChrystal or Petraeus, and Petraeus certainly is, by all accounts, not a stupid man. He's a smart man. Mm-hmm. But that goes along with being able to be stupid. So is this one of these cases where a very smart man is very stupid about his ability to win this war? I think not. I can't believe Petraeus really believes that. But he's ambitious enough to want to be given the job and to try to put it on the president. If you didn't give me enough resources, I can't do it. Is Obama so stupid? We know he's not stupid in general. So can Obama really believe that Petraeus can win this war for him, especially with the resources he's been given? I don't believe that. So I think our president is sending troops over there to kill and be killed in an effort that he knows cannot succeed by any reasonable measure, and that he prefers to do that than to subject himself to being called names before a congressional election and before a presidential election 2 years later, and that would hurt his legislative program and hurt his ability to get reelected. He's not the first president to make that kind of choice at all. He's just following in the footsteps of all the people who were indicted, I would say, by the Pentagon Papers in Vietnam.
Well, yeah, that didn't start in Vietnam either, unfortunately. But that, you know, to me, that, of course, is just so tragic, because my family's paying the price for that kind of, you know, using our young people as pawns and everything. But what gets me is that just recently we heard his spokesperson, Robert Gibbs, say that, you know, people on the professional left need to be drug tested, but they don't challenge the people that are on the professional right to say.
Well,
they talk about
WikiLeaks for being irresponsible for its big release, and reckless, and, you know, incredibly irresponsible. Those are words that certainly apply just incomparably more aptly to the people who got us into Iraq and into Afghanistan, and for that matter, you know, the other places we're attacking right now. I would call it very irresponsible to be sending drone attacks over Pakistan and destabilizing that country in the way that we're doing. And getting into war in Yemen and Somalia are not really good ideas either. And so we're really conducting war in all of those places. And asserting the right, by the way, to send assassination teams, death squads, all over the world at the president's at the president's will. So I would say that we really that irresponsibility is the best word you can use practically for these murderous operations.
Well, and then of course, instead of saying, "Well, let's investigate what's contained in these WikiLeaks tapes and documents," they say, "Let's find out how they got out and hold those people accountable," instead of holding themselves accountable for an untenable situation that our country finds itself in.
Well, you have the amazing rhetoric of their claiming that Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks and Assange have blood on their hands, and this from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or Secretary of Defense Gates or something, and I hesitate even to raise the image of how steeped in blood they are.
Blood on their hands doesn't even come close to it. They just bathe in blood. Like you said, steeped in blood.
They would have a problem, I would say, keeping their nose above water in the mm-hmm. sea of blood.
Absolutely. Well, that takes us to our next subject, and that's the war in Iraq that began in March of 2003. We've lost over 4,400 troops. We know at least 4,400. Many people I talk to say it's been way more deaths in Iraq of U.S. forces. Tens of thousands wounded, tens of thousands with post-traumatic stress disorder. Last year, 2009, was the first year more troops killed themselves than were killed in Iraq. The country lays in ruins. At least 4 or 5 million Iraqis have been either killed or displaced. And now we're supposed to believe, because the U.S. has changed the name from Operation Iraqi Freedom to Operation New Dawn and changed the names of the troops there from combat troops to support troops, that the war is over. What are your thoughts about that, Daniel?
I hadn't heard that last. Are you saying they've actually swiped MoveOn.org's name? Actually, it's now Operation Move On, is it?
No, Operation New Dawn.
Oh, New Dawn. Okay, I didn't hear
New
you
Dawn,
right.
Like it's
New
a,
Dawn.
Like it's a liquid or something. Something to wash our dishes with. It's new and improved.
Yeah. So I'm sure, by the way, what they're trying to get the American public to think about in Iraq is move on, don't think about it, we're out of there. I don't think we'll be out of there during your lifetime or my lifetime. Your lifetime will be longer than mine. But I think our children will live with U.S. bases being in Iraq, for a very long time. And there will be killing and dying in which they're involved during that time. The idea that there will be no combat, I think, is immediately contradicted by the plans we hear of keeping these big bases. They will not be manned or personed entirely by civilians, contract mercenaries, even if those are just recently retired military people. There will be military men there, I feel very confident, unfortunately. I'd be glad to be wrong about that. I do not foresee our turning over those Iraqi bases to Iraqis, essentially ever. I don't think they plan ever to do that. Granted, they have an agreement with the Bush administration, made an agreement with Maliki government, to have all troops out by the end of 2011, and Obama has always talked about keeping that. I don't think there's any chance that he will keep that. Any chance. It's certain. I think it's close to certain that that will not be the case. And thus, this is one more hoax that's being played on the American people. and the people of Iraq?
Well, it's absolutely a hoax. And what gets me is that there's anybody in this country that would believe that the war in Iraq is over just because they rebrand it and call it something different.
You know, Cindy, I've actually been very struck by the following point. In the discussions of Iraq, it's almost taken without any question that this promise that we'll be totally out of there by the end of 2011 will be met. It just isn't, they don't mention the possibility that we'll have 10, 20, 30, or 1,000 or more people there indefinitely. That's what I think is almost certain to happen. And yet, it's scarcely even mentioned by anybody. Have you noticed that?
Well, absolutely. And I'm going to be on a major network news tomorrow, and trust me, I'm going to talk about it. But another thing is, though, Daniel, is that if and when the military is out, and you and I both know that it's not ever going to be entirely out, that it's going to be turned over to the State Department using contractors.
It was a big article just today in the New York Times. And I noticed, at the first I thought, gee, yeah, this certainly does contradict what I've been saying and feeling, because they were talking about getting down, granted, to 7,000 security people for the State Department. I was thinking, well, 7,000 is a big number, but it's not nearly as big as I think they will need over there, or will have. So I was wondering, I do entertain always the possibility that I've been wrong. This mm-hmm. happens to be a subject that I'm really will be very surprised to be wrong about. But
right.
I was beginning to think, reading the article, that, gee, I have to really start taking that seriously. Maybe they do mean to get out of there. And then halfway through the article, I see our most recent ambassador there saying, I don't see how they're going to get away with more. They'll really need 20 or 30,000 more troops there, it seems to me. And I thought, I think he's making a good guess there.
Remember during the 2008 campaign when John McCain said that we'll be in Iraq for 100 years?
I thought that was a pretty realistic...
It was totally excoriated, but how long have we been in the Philippines? How long have we been in Japan and Germany?
Yeah, well, it's since the wars, and so it's
Seven, 65 years,
yeah. So,
right.
Yeah, we've been there, and that's what he was saying. Now, he did imply that most of that would be without any combat. Well, there I thought he's being unrealistic. No, there will be fighting, but in terms of the time, yes. And by the way, some British generals have made very comparable statements, 50 years, 60 years, and they've said it as assuming there would be some conflict. And having said that, of course, they always have to back off the next day or two under the protest of their own governments, or perhaps of our government. But
we're telling the truth.
I have said that if we turn over the bases entirely to Iraqis that we've built there, putting aside even our Vatican City size embassy, but putting aside the embassy, which is, I just read somewhere they were boasting that it could be seen from the outer space. It's so large. But, okay, just look at the other bases. I will say this. I'll repeat this. What could be a greater commitment to your audience, Cindy? If the United States turns over our other Iraqi bases to Iraqis by the end of 2011, or I'll give them the end of 2012 or 13, I will never make another prediction or estimate about anything to do with foreign policy. And that's not just a bet. I'm saying I will not trust my own intuition enough or understanding enough of the system anymore if that happens. That would be an entire change in my understanding of how this government operates and what the empire is.
Well, I'm going to trust your instincts. And the lead Iraqi general said, just the other day, at least 2020. He said he doesn't see U.S. troops leaving until at least 2020.
Well,
that's getting closer to our estimation.
I think most people shy away from making estimates of 100 years like McCain. But really, it's not as unrealistic as it may sound. The oil will probably last another 100 years. I don't think we'll want to be out of there while there's still oil. there. I think that we're more likely to give up New Jersey, where the oil is pretty exhausted, before we give up Iraq.
Well, what happens to, let's move on to our last subject. We only have, unfortunately, have a couple more minutes. What happens to the remnants of the U.S. military and the civilian contractors and our State Department, our diplomatic corps working in Iraq if, as some people think, the U.S. or Israel or the U.S. and Israel, it doesn't really matter, actually does bomb nuclear, so-called nuclear sites in Iran? And some people said by the end of this month that could be happening.
Yeah, that'll be, I think, a just total disaster for the world and for the Middle East and for this country if we commit aggression or collaborate with the Israelis in aggression against Iran. And we will certainly be seen in any Israeli attack as having collaborated with them. And there is about 100% chance that that perception will be correct. It's just
right.
Extremely unlikely, negligibly likely, that Israel could carry out that attack from beginning to end without the participation and collaboration of the United States. So they might, it's not impossible that they would move to produce a kind of fait accompli to provoke the U.S. into helping them, supporting them, and I think they would have could do that with great confidence under almost any president. So I think it's a very great danger, and this new article in The Atlantic by Jeffrey Goldberg, which comes close to calling for a U.S. to strike Israel, to strike Iran before Israel does, or in any case to back up Israel if they do it, is a real real effort to legitimize that, and it's already, that effort is pretty far gone. There's an awful lot of people in Congress right now, who, as you know, who are actually supporting openly the idea of an Israeli attack on Iran. But even the people who haven't done that openly, I think, yet, will do it once Israel attacks.
Once it happens, yes. So what do you think the chances are? I know our good friend Mike McGovern.
I think the reasons for not doing it from the point of view of the world or from the U.S. are extremely strong. And by the way, I don't think that our military is in favor of that. I get a strong impression that on that case, Mullen, for all the blood on his hands for past efforts and Gates, are not favorable to an attack on Iran, that the military really never have been. But that's not a full assurance by any means. I don't think they were actually in favor of going into Iraq. But the military people who wanted to do that were mostly retired, like Kagan and a few others. And acting military men, it was very hard to find a general officer who was actually in favor of attacking Iraq. But that didn't keep the president from doing it. And in this case, I don't think it's the president who's champing at the bit to do that. But Israel is, or I should say Israel is champing at the bit for the U.S. to do it. And the clearest way to get us to do it would be for them to move first, or to indicate that if we don't, they will, and press us in that respect. So we might as well get in there first and do it right, as opposed to getting in second and doing it right. So I think the chance is high, but not certain. I think it's, I have to say, I think it's more than 50%, and I say that extremely reluctantly, that it will happen within some time within the next year. There's a very interesting article by Trita Parsi on the Israeli motives for doing this, P-A-R-S-I, that I saw just the other day. And she indicated that they might instead be counting on using this approach to weaken Obama and get a Republican in who will be even more anxious to help the Israelis. That would mean putting it off for a couple of years. But I don't know. I don't think that's to be relied on. So I think that the next year or two are really very dangerous for the world from that point of view. We should be making every effort to press, demand that Obama take a public stand against their doing that. And I think he'd be very reluctant to do that and unlikely to do it, and yet it's what he should do, and it's what we should be demanding that he do.
Oh, thank you, Daniel. Thank you for being on the show again, and thank you for all your tireless work for peace and for justice and for actually common sense in the world.
Oh, I'll say the same to you, Cindy, and of course what you did had a big effect on public opinion, rightly so, did not get us out of Iraq, as we've just agreed,
right, but
we have to do what we can, and I thank you for all that you've done.
That was my dear friend and dear friend of peace and justice, like I said, and common sense, Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers. Well, that was Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Thank you again for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you tune in next week. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Petty, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, and my producer, Mikey, Daniel Ellsberg, for agreeing to be on the show again, and especially you for listening. Again, please tune in next week. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.